Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition of Planet Porky. Yes, that's Planet Porky. That's where I am, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are we this fine day?
Yeah, I'm very happy, actually. I took my mother to have her second jab yesterday. And so she's all fully jabbed up. And it's a sense of great relief among all of us, really, that she's 85, you know.
Yeah.
But within a week now, she should have full protection. So if
Fantastic.
She does happen to contract the virus going forward,
yeah.
It shouldn't be a serious illness for her. It should be something that she can shrug off quite easily. So
yeah.
I'm feeling very happy about that.
That's great. It's only about a week, isn't it, between the two jabs? I thought it was 3 weeks.
No, it's 21 days.
Oh,
she 21 had the
days,
previous one before Christmas. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Oh, that's great. Oh, well, I'm really pleased for you, Mum. That's great.
Thank you.
I've had some terrible rows over the last 48 hours with people because I'm totally anti-lockdown, as you know. I didn't want lockdown one or two or three, and I didn't want this one, but I'm afraid we are where we are now. And the thing about lockdowns is if you lift them, the cases start going up again. And the last thing we need is cases going up again at a time when we're now rolling out the vaccine, where you and I, or where I'm talking from now, if I go into my roof garden and look out over the North Downs, I can see the roof of the main stand at Epsom Racecourse. Okay. And at Epsom Racecourse today, they're rolling out a vaccination centre there where they're hoping to inoculate 200,000 people a week. That's real progress. That's what we've got to do. And while that's going on, I don't think I can start beating the drum any longer for lift lockdown, because it'll torpedo it.
You know, it's been a complete volt fast for you, hasn't it? But
it's had to
I
be.
Remember my friend at Whitehall, my mole at
yeah.
Whitehall,
yeah.
said to me on New Year's Day, this is an absolutely horrible variety and it's spreading madly.
Yeah.
Hospitals in London are almost full. This was New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And the peak is not expected for another 10 days or so, which is now. So we're in the peak of the eye of the storm at the moment and
yeah.
everybody needs to stay home.
Yeah.
You look at these pictures in the papers and on television of hundreds of people strolling along beaches, meeting their friends for coffee in the
yeah.
park. It's,
well,
what are they thinking?
I've got an idea.
If they do lock us down, if they do
yeah.
say, right, everybody stays home and only goes out the door once a week to go shopping
yeah.
and have a quick walk around, I will not be surprised.
Yeah. Well, you've only got to look at the Tottenham Hotspur bus arriving at Marine yesterday. Marine is a little football club in Crosby, just on the edge of Liverpool. And of course, there was such excitement at Spurs turning up at this eighth-tier club. And it was like there was no pandemic. Honestly, the crowds flocked onto the streets around the Tottenham coach like nothing was going on. And that's what happens. People just suddenly forget in times of high excitement. But look, to make it clear to all the people who I've been communicating with, as I say, over the last 24, 36 hours, I'm still against lockdown. I still don't think it works. But it is what it is. It's what we've got now. And I would like to see the pubs reopen. I'd like to see the schools reopen. I don't think they're dangerous, but it's too much of a risk now when we could just be 6 weeks away from officially good news, you know, the half-term break in February. And I'm afraid you've just got to go with what we've got. That's what I think. But anyway,
well,
there we are.
Isn't that contradicting yourself, what you
no,
just said?
No, because
so you're
I don't...
against lockdown, but you think we should have it?
I'm against lockdowns. And one of the reasons I'm against lockdowns is because when they end, you get a spike and the infections go up. So we can't afford to end this lockdown, even though I don't agree with it, because it'll spike and the numbers will go up. But you could talk your way through this all day long, honestly, and it just goes on and on and on. Let's just get the vaccine rolled out. I go out in the garden, stare over the downs at the Epsom Racecourse and think, great, salvation is here. Talking about medicine and vaccines and all that kind of stuff, I've come across an incredible story, which I want to tell you, Miss Jones, and it's about my own salvation. Now, as you know, and everybody who's listening will know, I've bored them to death with the story for 15 years. I was on the heart transplant list for 7 months in 2004, right? And I was in hospital and told I wasn't going anywhere until I got a heart transplant. Now, in the end, I couldn't stay any longer. I just decided I didn't want to because, A, my career was disappearing down the tubes. B, my life was disappearing. I just didn't know how long I was going to be there because it's how long is a piece of string when you're waiting for a heart transplant. So I signed myself off and left. And miraculously, I'm still here and I'm healthier now than I was when I was in that hospital bed. I just started exercising, ended up walking the Great North Run marathon, half marathon, 3 years later and all that kind of stuff. But the reason for that was because I was given a tablet called Carvedilol. And Carvedilol is what's known as a beta blocker. It's there to try and strengthen the muscles in your heart, okay? And Carvedilol worked for me, turned my life around. That one and another one called Allopurinol, which I take to this day, I take them both, and made me stronger. However, in about the last 18 months, I've started getting weaker again. And that's a combination of age and the fact that I'd started putting weight on again, because as you get older, you do. And just general sort of, you know, wearing out. And then I read a piece in a newspaper. I'm so glad that I try to read every newspaper every day. And I always read the medical columns because, obviously, having a medical condition, I look at it. Anyway, I read about a new drug they were bringing out, and it is called Dapagliflozin, okay? And it's actually for diabetes too, but they found in giving it to diabetics, of which I'm one, it helps the heart process. Anyway, I wrote to my consultant doctor at Harefield and I pointed this out, and I've done it a dozen times before, and they're very reluctant to take any notice of what's written in newspapers, okay? But I persisted and persisted, and eventually I got a consultation at the hospital, and they said, okay, we're going to try you on this Dapagliflozin. And that was around about November of last year. I have remarkably improved since then. I'm not joking. It is like another miracle cure. I've regained energy. I've started losing weight again. I've got the appetite to walk. It honestly is a medical miracle.
Have you had any of the side effects? So I was reading about this. Yeah. Hyperglycemia, thrush, UTIs, running to the loo, low blood pressure, things like that.
No. No, I haven't. One of the problems of getting diabetes was they put me on some drugs. Now, that's a year ago. And they gave me all those conditions you've just talked about. I mean, honestly, you just could not leave the house if I'd taken these drugs. It's so disturbed your insides. I'm not joking. You're either vomiting or you were needing to rush to the loo and all that. And that went on for about 6 months. And then I had no option but to say, I can't take these drugs anymore. They're destroying me. You know, they were making me fat and swollen and all that kind of stuff. So I stopped taking them. I got better, but then I started taking this latest one, I can never pronounce it,
Dapagliflozin.
That's right, Dapagliflozin. And I'm not joking. I wake up every day now with a smile on my face. I feel so much better. It really has honestly been miraculous.
I think that's the thing about these medications. You know, if they add to your quality of life, if they improve your daily existence, then they're worth taking. But they're not for everyone. And they do have to be trialed and observed very carefully.
Yeah. But what's amazing about this is the reason I've told you this story is this is another piece I read in the paper only this weekend about a chap aged 44 who was waiting for a heart transplant. Right. And then suddenly they tried this drug on him, Dapagliflozin. And he now doesn't need a heart transplant. He's gone through the same sort of, you know, miracle that I went through when I started taking the one called Carvedilol. And good luck to him. I tell you what the big problem is with this. It's very expensive, this pill, and it can cost up to £244 a year. When I wrote to my consultant, £244 a year. You know, would good be a subscription God. To get the...
Well, that would be their main reluctance for giving it to you because it's a huge financial commitment. But, I mean, quite frankly, you would pay for it.
I volunteered to. I said to my consultant, look, I can imagine the strain under which the NHS exists. This was way before pandemic, by the way. This was over a year ago. I said, I'm very happy to pay for that myself. In fact, it was quoted to me as more expensive. It was quoted to me as £35 a month. So it was going to be £350 a year. And I said I would happily pay it. Anyway, we got through all the red tape and all that. I'm now taking it. And I have to say it's changed my life. So there we go. A miracle story.
Fantastic. That's great to hear. Yeah, long may it last for you.
Yeah. And also, I'm very happy for the chap involved in the story. A young fellow, as I say, 44-year-old, father of two, electrician, Daniel Smith from Nottingham, diagnosed with heart failure triggered by a viral infection, fit and healthy prior to this. He became bedbound and thought his life was over. Then all of a sudden, this miracle drug comes along. He's got his life back and he can play with his kids. So I'm very, very happy for him indeed. Let's talk about much happier stories altogether, Miss Jones. And I have to say, I was so thrilled to read a scientific report in my journals in the last couple of days saying that high heels are in fact very, very good for women. I love to see a woman in a pair of 5-inch high heels. And the headline on the story I read said, "Scientists prove high heels really are sexy." So, Miss Jones, what about your range of high heels?
Oh, for God's sake. Have you ever tried walking in a pair of high heels?
Of course not, because I'm a man and men don't wear high heels. Well, not
well, I can tell you something. They are the most uncomfortable, crippling, excruciating things known to man. Therein lies the reason. They were originally developed to inhibit the movement of women. It was a way of men controlling their females, like the ancient Japanese so-called art of foot binding, which is one of the most barbaric practices ever invented. Dang. And high heels were created to stop women running away from men. Dang. And most women will tell you, yes, most women will tell you that they are crippling to wear, which is why when you go out clubbing, if you still do, like we did in the old days, you'd see women hobbling out of clubs, clutching their white stilettos in their hand because they could no longer bear to wear them. Yeah. They are awful things. They're terrible for your feet. They give you bunions. And I'm thoroughly so glad that I don't have to wear them anymore.
Golly, that sounds very matronly. I must say, Miss Jones, I mean, what about your heroines like Dame Joan Collins, who was on the box again this morning with our friend Piers? She wouldn't be seen dead without high heels.
Yeah, she never wears them. I've never seen her in a pair of high heels.
Oh, of course you have. What about when she played Electra in Dynasty?
I mean, playing a part is different when you're on a set, isn't it? And you kind of move around in a very limited way, but not out in real life. No, it's a pair of trainers. And the older you get, the more comfortable you want your footwear to be.
Well, I'm afraid that's very unsexy. I think high heels are wonderful. In fact, here, what about this quote here from Marilyn Monroe? "I don't know who invented high heels, but all women owe him a lot." So Marilyn Monroe loved high heels. That's good enough for me, OK?
It works up to the age of 30. After that, I mean, women are not women up until the age of 30, are they? So what you're really saying is you're lusting after young girls.
No, we're not lusting after young girls. That's an outrageous slur to put against me. What I'm saying is, as I was growing up, right, certainly in my 20s, my 30s, I was always attracted by a woman in high heels. I just think they look great. They look sexy. They look elegant. Who's the bloke who makes them with red soles on the bottom? I mean, you know, that's the height of
Manolo Blahnik, yes. Do you remember there was a scandal a while back because some boss decided that women had to wear them in the office?
That's right, yes, I do.
It was a male boss who said females had to wear skirts and they had to wear high heels.
Yes.
And there was a huge backlash about
it
at the time
from
females who said, "Have you ever tried wearing these damn things?"
Well,
you know, they cripple you and they do hold you back. Try running for a bus or a taxi in a pair of high heels.
Well,
you're going to break your neck.
Don't you go out at night in high heels and you expect a car to turn up and somebody to open the door and you get in the back of the limo?
Yeah, well, real life isn't like that, matey, I tell you.
Well, here, I'm going to put you up against the Mail on Sunday's You magazine fashion editor, Sophie Dearden, who says, quotes, right, she says, "I'm not surprised women were perceived as more attractive when wearing heels. I personally feel way more confident when in heels. They elevate your look and the way you hold yourself. Confidence is very attractive." How about that?
Yeah, but she's only about 12. You know, let her get to 35 and then deal with the bunions and be going to the chiropodist and in pain and the chiropodist telling you, "Well, you've brought this upon yourself, madam, you know, wearing high heels. Get the trainers out."
Well, OK, we have to agree to disagree. I'm afraid a woman in high heels and long legs and you know, finery and all that kind of stuff. But there we go. I'm a man. You're a woman.
Oh, you fetishist. Calm down, dear.
How dare you? How dare you? Listen, talking about women, by the way, there's this amazing woman. You'll probably know more about her than I do. But have you ever read the book, The Amazing Mr. Ripley, or whatever it's called? The Talented Mr.
Ripley. I haven't, actually. No, Patricia Highsmith, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's American
right.
Author.
Yeah. She would have been 100 today. And she was so notorious. Somebody's written a sort of memoir about her. Have you read it? It's quite shocking.
Well, I read about it in the press. I did. What a strange woman carrying around 100 snails, live snails, in a handbag.
And, yeah, why would you do that?
And why would you do that? Unless you're going to eat them, I suppose, yeah, with a cocktail stick. Mm. But there were all these stories about she took 10 lovers a day, not just men, but women as well, and sometimes both at once.
Yes.
And she seems to have modelled this character, Mr. Ripley, on herself.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
She was a murderous psychopath. I don't know if she murdered anybody in real life, but she recorded thoughts of death and killing people in her own intimate diaries, which I think have recently been published.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite astonishing. The Talented Mr. Ripley sounds like quite a warm title to me, but I've never read it or never seen the film. But the film actually starred Matt Damon, who went on to, you know, get worldwide fame as Jason Bourne, didn't he? Same guy, isn't it? And apparently, Mr. Ripley was a psychopath. You're right, I think.
So a very charming psychopath who sort of lures people into his confidence and then basically knocks them off.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But the other great thing I like about her, and she gets marks, you know, she gets 9 out of 10 for this from me, is she was not just an alcoholic, she drank every waking moment of her life. So when she got up in the morning, the first thing she did was reach for the whiskey bottle. And the last thing she did at night was, you know, down some champagne cocktails or something like that. And in between, she was never seen without a glass in her hand. I mean, that's some going, isn't it?
It is. But did you see the photographs of her? She looks monstrous. So I think alcoholism did not do her any favours.
Well, it doesn't do anybody any favours. It says here, when it came to alcohol, Highsmith was in a class of her own. By middle age, she was frequently drunk from breakfast. You know that old thing I accuse you of having put too much sherry on your cornflakes sometimes?
Have you seen me eating cornflakes?
Well, yeah, I know, but you know what I mean. And I think this woman actually used to do it. She says, Highsmith was in a class of her own. Middle age, she was frequently drunk from breakfast until bedtime, counterpointing her intake of a favourite gin with quarter pint shots of whiskey. She would drink a quarter of a pint of whiskey. Well, if I have a sip of whiskey, I don't know if you've ever been a whiskey drinker, it's so
burns. I hate whiskey. It's awful stuff.
I hate whiskey. It so burns the back of my throat. You know, I can't even stand the smell of whiskey, let alone drinking it.
It makes me feel sick, yeah. This is Geoffrey Bernard territory, though, isn't it?
Well, it's worse than Geoffrey Bernard. Did you used to see Geoffrey Bernard in your...
The Groucho,
yeah.
I mean, what a mess he was. Mind you, she looked a bit like him, I suppose. Alcohol does have this dreadful effect on a person's face.
Yes,
and they start to get that bloodhound look, you know, that very sort of everything's drooping and your skin looks very grey.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't think it's a good look. I don't think it's a good idea to drink from morning through noon until night.
Well, I know people who do, believe it or not. And
We all do. But I mean, Elaine Page, of all people, once told me that she has one of those tiny bottles of champagne, you know, the champagne for one kind of size.
Yes, I know, yeah.
She has one of those every morning before she gets out of bed, because she has as a bedside table a little fridge, you know, those tiny personal fridges.
Yes.
She's got one by her bed as her bedside table.
Yes.
Get it out. Mm. And she reaches for one of those every morning before she gets up.
Really? You see, there's something in the psych about that, because myself, like most people, have a Moorism thing with alcohol. So, for instance, I'll be going to get some blood tests today, okay? I know it's lockdown and all that, but I've got a special dispensation to go to the surgery and to get my bloods taken, which are then sent off to Harefield Hospital to examine how I'm doing. That's instead of having to go to Harefield Hospital, you see what I mean? Which is great. Now, the point is, obviously, because you'd be a nutter to do it any other way, I then have to fast all day today and obviously not have a drink until I've had my bloods taken, okay? But on a normal day, I would probably have a drink at about 1 o'clock. Certainly if lockdown wasn't here, I would have gone to the pub by 1 o'clock, okay? Because I love a lunchtime.
Every day?
Yeah, most days, yeah. But you can remember, I was brought up in a world where we finished work at 10 o'clock. For 6 years, I finished work at 10 o'clock a.m. We were in the pub by 10:30, you know, because that was the end of our working day, so to speak, when I was doing a breakfast show with Alan Brazil. So I've sort of grown up in that sort of. But most days, I prefer working in the morning and then sorting things out in the afternoon. And a visit to the pub in between has always been part of my routine. Now, Obviously, I won't be going to the pub today because I've got the blood test at 4:15. But if, you know, you could say, oh, well, I'll tell you what.
Pubs are closed anyway.
Well, they're closed anyway. But, I won't open a bottle of beer in the house or anything like that, for instance, you know. Now, the thing is, the moreism thing I'm talking about is that almost everybody I know, once they start drinking of a day, they don't just put it down and go away. They normally keep going. And I don't, certainly that's my case. If I go to the pub at lunchtime and have a few pints, I will easily be there till 4 o'clock, no problem at all. I won't be drunk, but I like a few pints and I like the atmosphere of the pub, no problem. So I can't see how Elaine Page can honestly take, you know, a couple of mouthfuls of champagne to start her day and then not continue doing it all day, because that's what most people, that's where most people fall foul of alcohol. They can't stop it once they've started drinking it.
I think, and I don't want to be sexist about it, yeah, but I think it's different for women. I can very easily have one or two drinks and stop there. You know, we've been out, haven't we, lots, yes, of times for lunch and dinner and so on. And yeah, I'm happy to sit and have a couple of G&Ts with you, yeah, or share a bottle of wine over dinner. Yeah. But I then don't want any more and I can stop. Whereas my former husband was like you. He'd be on a roll. He'd come home from work. We'd open a bottle of red over dinner. Yeah. And then he'd carry on drinking for the rest of the evening. And then things would get out of hand.
Yeah, well, I can so understand
that. I think maybe women have some better ability to draw a line, to stop.
I think you may be right. Because, see, my sister Jill is a cordon bleu chef, okay? Now, whenever I go to a house in Bournemouth, what happens is that myself and my brother-in-law, that's Jill's husband, we will always go to the pub at about midday when Jill will start making the lunch, and we'll get back by about 1:30 or 2 o'clock, you know what I mean? Now, what happens is we go out and have those few pints. We have a drink with Jill in the house before we go, and you're absolutely right, she has a glass of champagne. But then when we come back at 1:30 and then we start drinking again until lunch, Jill won't drink then because she's cooking. She just enjoys that glass of champagne. You're absolutely right. And she's able then just to turn it off, you know what I mean?
Do you know, as well, I used to get very sick if I drank too much. And we all drank too much when we were young. You'd, yeah, go out, you're having fun. And I used to get so ill. Mm. There were times when I couldn't get out of bed, you know. So I think we learn as well to modulate our intake over time.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have been every time you had a drink, would it?
No, I wasn't allergic to it or anything, but I didn't have an off switch as a young person.
Yeah.
And we were very much in a drinking culture,
yeah,
working in journalism. You know, we were surrounded by drinkers. They, yes, taught us how to drink.
Yes.
But I always had a limit beyond which it would make me ill.
Well, before my heart went, and my heart went in 2004, I was such a capable drinker that I never got a hangover. I've never had a hangover before 2004. I could drink until 1 a.m, you know, out with people in Fleet Street, you know, in Soho and all that kind of stuff, and easily turn up at 6:30 for work the next morning, fresh as a daisy, having had a shower and everything, and no visible or mental signs of a hangover, honestly. All that changed after my heart went, and now I have to be very careful. The most dangerous place now for me, Leslie Ann, is the club class compartment of a transatlantic aeroplane, because it's free. So I ain't going to stop it coming to my table while it's free for the 7 hours it takes to fly to New York. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I tell you something else that I think is true. When women are pregnant, we stop drinking because, yes, we should.
Yes.
It's good for the baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really shouldn't drink alcohol at all, yeah, during pregnancy. Mm. So during my first pregnancy, I gave up, because that was the right thing to do.
Yes.
I never recovered my capacity after,
really?
That. And I've had two babies since then.
Yeah.
They're all grown up now. But,
yeah,
each time I found that I couldn't resume, not that I'm an alk or anything, but, yeah, everybody likes a drink,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
But I could never resume the capacity that I'd had as a young woman.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, that worked to your advantage. Because if you were craving for drink, it would be more difficult not to drink. Drink does damage us all. So I think really that was to your advantage that you got turned off drink.
Yeah, I'm a much cheaper date these days.
Much cheaper date indeed. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening to the latest episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you also, and I bring you to this conversation, Leslie Ann, for all the feedback we're getting on it now. We really are building up a very loyal army of listeners, and the information they give us back after listening to the podcast is A, very, very nice, but B, very instructive as well as to what people like to hear us talk about.
Yeah, it is. Not everybody agrees with us, and why should they? You know, yeah. It takes all sorts to make a world, and there are all kinds of opinions. But it is lovely hearing from listeners, and some of the exchanges, especially on Twitter, are really amusing. Yeah. Keep it coming, because it lightens our day, and hope it does yours.
Absolutely. We've talked a bit about the Bee Gees and Robin Gibb recently, but Robin Gibb's been doing another round of talking now from his home in Miami under lockdown.
Well, it might not be Robin Gibb doing that, because he's been dead for a few years.
Oh, Barry, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Yes. Well done.
Barry's the last one left.
Yeah, Barry.
And that's a shame, because he's the eldest.
Well, I was about to say, he's got this guilt syndrome that he's the only brother left. That must be a shocking thing for him to have to live with.
Yeah, especially being the eldest. He's 74, isn't he?
Yes.
And Robin and Morris, they were twins.
Yeah.
They both died ahead of him, as did the very youngest brother, Andy, who died of a drug overdose back in the
80s. Yes, he did, yeah.
So, yes, you do, I'm sure, get this thing of survivor's guilt. Why me? Yeah. Why was I spared and my brothers were taken?
Yeah. But also, when you deny the people with whom you created so much magic, and think of Lennon McCartney and Lennon gone. I know they weren't working together then, but they still created so much magic together. There's nobody there now for Barry Gibb to turn to and say, what do you think about that? You know, when he's played a few chords of a new song or something, and that must be very hurtful for him to be...
On the other hand, yeah, but he gets to spend all the royalties by himself, doesn't he?
Oh, come on, that's very cruel. I mean, I can believe he does miss his brothers. They must have been very close.
I'm sure he does. Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned Lennon and McCartney. Why wouldn't we? Because we always do.
Yes.
So Barry Gibb shares with Lennon McCartney the record for the most consecutive Billboard Hot 100 number ones in America, each of them having six.
Oh, golly.
You never would have thought that, would you?
No, I wouldn't. What about Presley and all those people? You know, I mean.
Yeah, well, Presley didn't write songs anyway, but no one comes anywhere near. But I mean, if you think about all the Saturday Night Fever songs, so there was Night Fever, wasn't there? Staying Alive.
Yeah.
And then all the other kind of hits, You Win Again, Jive Talking, Tragedy. Yes. Yeah. Spirits Having Flown, that was my favourite.
I love that Spirits Having Flown, and yet
I do as well.
You never find that on one of their compilations. I don't know why. It's like, you know, Spirits Having Flown. I loved it. And there's another one with a huge drum beat that it opens. Here We Go Again or something like that.
You Win Again.
That's right, You Win Again.
That's a great song as well, yeah. They wrote some great songs.
Yeah.
I think they're a bit overlooked, actually. I think people seem to think they're Australian for some reason.
Well, they lived there after they were born
in Manchester. They were born on the Isle of Man.
On the Isle of Man, was it? Yeah, yeah. And ended up in Manchester, I think, didn't they?
The family migrated to Queensland.
Yes.
When they were kids.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And then came back, and man, they conquered the world. Now, Miss Jones, we were talking in the first part of this podcast about your friend Elaine Page, who wakes up every morning in her bed, reaches for a glass of champagne. Have you seen this latest ghastly phenomenon that lockdown's brought upon us? And, you know, at the moment, people use this these letter symbols, working from home, WFH, you know what I mean? It's become part of the common patter. There's now a WFB. Working from bed.
I am aware of this, and I am surrounded by a few people who are actually doing that. My daughter sometimes takes meetings from her bed.
You're joking.
Because she's not on screen. You know, she hosts these meetings, but she doesn't reveal herself in all her glorious pajamaed terribleness.
I can't believe this.
Sight for sore eyes, yeah.
I can't believe it. And not only is the WFB becoming more and more popular, but Amazon are now shipping out specially designed laptop trays for bed workers. So you know, like when you're old and you're in hospital, somebody brings you your breakfast on a like a a stool, really, that they put across.
Oh, I hate those things. Body. I hate eating in bed. It always goes wrong, don't you think? I mean, always toast crumbs in the sheets and you spill the orange juice or your coffee's running down your chin.
I was about to say, the idea of breakfast in bed to me is just hideous. It's torture.
It's gross.
I totally agree with you. It's disgusting to start off with, as you say, toast all over the place, spilt drinks and all that. I have all my life, the minute I've woken up, I get out of bed. It doesn't matter what time it is. It can be as early as 4:30, which it will be if I've, you know, had a regular day the day before. It could sometimes be as late as maybe 6:30 if I've had a very late night and been on the razz or something like that. But the minute I open my eyes, I have to get out of bed and get on with life and get on with things. The idea of sitting in bed with this tray across your lap, which is a bed office, because it's got special holes for you putting your you know, no, your wires through to lap, you know, to sign up your laptop and all that kind of stuff. I mean, good God.
It's terribly bad for your posture. So, if you lie in bed too long, you get backache.
Yes.
And just lying there, the blood is pooling in your legs and that kind of thing. You need to get your circulation going. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. You do need to get out of bed and get moving.
Yeah.
Get the blood flowing around the body. It's really bad for your heart to sit around.
Yeah.
In years gone by, I've sometimes, you know, when you've been on holiday and you look at people lying around the pool and stuff, and you see certain people, they lie there all day long.
Yes.
They don't even get up. Maybe they get up once to maybe go and get a drink, go to the loo or something, but they lie there and lie there. And you think that's awfully bad for you, you know.
Of course it is.
You've got to move around.
Look, I totally agree. So it says here, Argus sells a range of portable laptop trays suitable for balancing on your bed. Not only that, there's been a huge surge in the sales of wedge pillows to prop themselves up while working. John Lewis.
Those V-shaped things. I used to have one of those. I threw it away.
Exactly. John Lewis said sales were up 65% this month compared to the same period last year. Oh, my God.
Have you ever tried changing a pillowcase on one of those things?
Are they like triangular shaped?
Yeah, they are. And I threw it away in the end in frustration because I could not get the legs of this V-shaped pillow into the pillowcase. The pillowcase ended up ripping diagonally from one end to the other.
Yeah.
And in disgust, I chucked it. I mean, who needs this thing anyway? I only go to bed to sleep, you know?
Exactly. I've never really understood it. It also says, and I've got a bit of sympathy for this, people who live in multi-share houses often have nowhere else to go except the bedroom. And in some places, the bedroom is so small you can't get a desk in it. They have no option but to work from their bed.
Well, I do understand that. And, you know, it's all very well for us with houses and gardens and we've got room to move around.
Sure.
If they are bringing in this thing of we can only go outside once a week, this is going to be hell for people in high-rise flats.
Of course it is. It doesn't matter thingy. Talking about flat sharing, by the way, did you ever go through a period of flat sharing during your life?
No, never. I never wanted to.
No, well, you're very lucky because I never wanted to. But when I worked on the Chester Chronicle in Chester, still very young, I lived at home because it was just easy, you know what I mean? And so did all my mates. Oh, excuse me a sec, hang on.
Shall I get that? Oh, he's only taking the call. He's live on air on the podcast. He's taking the call. Let's just talk amongst myself, shall I, while we wait for Mr. Parry to return. Sorry, everyone.
I'm so sorry about that. Now, I'll tell you. Exactly
who was that? That it was more important than this podcast?
You won't believe it. It's the newspaper boy. Now, this is interesting, right? And most mornings I get up and I go off for a stroll down the hill and I get my papers and bring them back, okay? What's happened over the last week, and I thought it had been fixed, is that the chap who drives the thank you, just come through the door. The chap who drives the the truck that brings the newspapers,
the van
that brings it from the wholesalers. He got
the vehicle.
The vehicle, that's right. Yeah, and it's usually like a beaten up old white transit van that used to be. Long to British Telecom or something, you know what I mean? He got COVID. So I went down the other morning and we're all waiting there because they're usually there by six, but sometimes it's 5 minutes past. No, quarter past six. No, half past six, quarter to seven. Anyway, problem is the bloke in the white van delivers them to all the newspaper outlets in the area. So the local garage didn't have any, Tesco's didn't have any, the newsagent didn't have any, no papers. And they didn't get there till half ten. And I thought, well, you've got to sort this out. That went on all week. It was disaster. It was disaster. Now, it got better over the weekend. And I was working over the weekend and I thought, that's good. Clearly, something's happened again this morning. And the vehicle man is once again not there. What are you laughing
at? You could just read them online. You don't even have to get out of bed to read the papers.
No, I insist on having a newspaper in my hand and feeling it and smelling the ink and the beauty of the production of it. You can't get all that. What are you chuckling for, Miss Jones? You've been in newspapers all your life.
Yes, of course, but I don't need any of those things aforementioned. I can just read it on my screen at my desk. You could have digested all of that 4 hours ago.
Some of them you have to pay for, don't you? I think you have to pay.
Yeah,
for
there's some of them are behind paywalls. Yeah,
that's right. Mail online isn't though, is it? You can get mail online.
No, it isn't, but they are making it more difficult to read. So they do this thing where you've been reading for a couple of minutes and then the screen starts flashing wildly as they want you to subscribe and stuff, but I never do.
Yeah, oh, well, they're very thrifty, Miss Jones. Yes, well done. Now...
Get it while you can, Mike, you know?
Get it while you can? Come on, Miss Jones, it's a family show, for goodness sake. One minute we're talking about high heels, which you don't like, who they're no good, and then you're saying, come on, get it while you can. I don't know. I don't get any sense out of you today.
You're always determined to misunderstand everything I say.
No, as a woman who's mixed with all the great rock stars over the last couple of decades, have you ever had any association with Jimmy Page?
Yeah, I have.
That with great enthusiasm.
I'm not mad about Jimmy Page. I know he's a wondrous musician. Yeah. He used to be one of the most sought-after session guys in the early days before he joined Led Zeppelin. Right. He founded Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
They call him the pontiff of the power riff, don't they? I mean, he's a marvellous musician, but he's had a very dodgy past, you know.
Well, yes, I know what you're talking about here. He's 77 anyway today. He's got a very young girlfriend, so that might give some indication of what you're hinting at, although, of course, he is a thoroughly respectable man without a stain on his record. And also, the thing about him is he was part of an incredible supergroup, wasn't he, Led Zeppelin? And I read that the reason they called it Led Zeppelin was because Keith Moon, the famous drummer from The Who, he was having a conversation with Jimmy Page. Jimmy Page said, exactly what you've just said, I'm fed up of being a session musician, I'm going to form my own group. And Keith Moon said, you form a group, Jimmy, you'll be the only decent one in it. You'll go down like a lead balloon. And that led... So Jimmy Page, to thwart him, called the group Led Bloom first, but then thought that's not very evocative. Zeppelin's better. And then changed Led from LEAD to LED because he said the Americans will pronounce it as Lead Zeppelin and it won't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, interesting band. They weren't really my cup of tea. I suppose I was too young. Yeah. Also, they were very much associated with the Hells Angels.
Yes.
Back in the early days. And the Hells Angels kind of followed them around and played all their music and stuff. So if you were nice little quaint girl guidey girls, as we were in my school, you stayed away from all of that. That was dirty music, you know.
Well,
and I suppose I never really got into it until I was much older.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Have you seen him play a guitar with a cello bow?
No.
Yeah, it's quite...
And
quite
is that
a
quite a gifted thing to do, is it?
Well, it's one of his kind of techniques. He's got all these guitar techniques, like just distorted guitar sounds and unusual tunings and things like that. A very interesting man, but very complex and strange.
Okay, well, that's very interesting, except that, of course, we prefer to talk about, you know, family life on this
podcast.
Shows. But what I was going to say is the one interesting thing about, well, there's lots of interesting things about Jimmy Page, but he and the Take That singer, Robbie Williams. Have had this like 15-year feud because they both live in super houses worth about £12 to £15 million in, is it Hampstead?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, and they hate each other, because when one tries to make some sort of renovation to their property, the other then goes mad and starts suing them, saying, you're going to shake the foundations of my property. And this has been going on for years, to the extent where Jimmy Page has been reported as having been sat in a car in the street with a pair of binoculars spying on Robbie Williams. I mean, that sort of thing, you know, can destroy people's lives when you've got a neighbour dispute like that.
It's very odd, though, because Jimmy Page lives most of the time in Sonning in Berkshire.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. So he's not actually in that house most of the time. So why is it bothering him, other than the fact that it's shaking the foundations of his old tapestries?
Yeah. Well, it's apparently, I've never been there, obviously, but apparently it's built like a sort of French chateau, isn't it? And it's, you know, a lot of delicate work has gone on in the construction of the house and the foundations and all that. And I suppose, quite rightly, he's trying to protect his own property, and you can't blame him for that. So. But I tell you what, neighbour disputes, Leslie, and I don't know if you've ever been involved in one, they can chip away at your life. They chip away at your confidence. They chip away at your self-belief and the sanctity of your home. They're horrible. I hate neighbour disputes.
I've never had one. I've always been very fortunate with neighbours. Yeah. I've always made a point of befriending them at arm's length. So, you know, not in and out of each other's houses, but I'll look after your keys, you look after my keys, we take packages in, all that kind of thing. Yeah. It's very important to be friendly with your neighbours, because they're right there. Every single day you come out of your house, go back in, they are right there.
Sure.
So you don't want to be feuding with people that you've got to see every day.
No, I totally agree. I've told the story famously. I'm not sure I've ever told you. I had a house once, and it was a new house on a new estate. And then all of a sudden, the people moved in next door, and it was a female, and she was a prison governor. And she used to bring all the prison guards. They were, by the way, this is a woman's prison they were in charge of, about sort of 6 miles away. And she used to bring all the prison guards home at the end of the shift at 10 o'clock at night, OK? And by 11 o'clock, ABBA was bursting through the walls, booming. By 1 in the morning, the decibel level had gone up to unsleepable along the street. And I had to get up in the middle of the night and go around and complain. I ended up, believe it or not, having to invoke the help of the then Home Secretary, David Blunkett, because, of course, the Home Secretary is in charge of prisons, amongst other things, and eventually got it sorted. But they were just out of control. They all came back in the early hours of the morning and had these wild parties.
You talked about that before,
actually. Yeah, I think
that must have really affected you very badly.
It was awful. I hated it. And they were all threatening me because they were very butch, these prison guards, believe me. Very butch women.
I bet they were.
With very short haircuts.
Yeah. The thing to do in a situation like that is not to go and make yourself known.
Yeah.
It's to call the police and to stay anonymous, because once they know who you are, they're going to terrorise you.
Yeah, but I couldn't stay anonymous because I was knocking on the door every night saying, can you turn the effing music down, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
They were trying to wind you up.
Yeah, well, I suppose so. Now, what about this? We always knew that if there's somebody who's an unfortunate on the street sitting there and asking for money, if he gets himself a dog, or she gets herself a dog, there's likely to be more sympathy from the passing public who will give them money. That's now extended, Miss Jones, to these dating websites where men now hug a little puppy whilst they're, you know, putting their profile picture up and talking about themselves. And apparently they get 10 times more hits from women who want to date them than a man without a puppy. Would a puppy attract you to a man?
I would personally run a mile from a bloke who did that. But then I run a mile from dating websites anyway.
Yeah,
I think, you know, two rules. One, things are never what they seem.
Yeah.
Two, if something or someone looks too good to be true, they usually are. And I think the kind of people who advertise themselves on dating websites are not the kind of people I would want to date.
Yeah.
End of.
No, I totally agree. I can't understand dating websites. If somebody's so desperate for company, they've got to go on a dating website, then they, that individual, so that's me or you if we start doing it, we're wacko characters anyway and shouldn't impose ourselves upon somebody else.
Quite right. Too needy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in the kind of people who would not, under any circumstances, advertise themselves on a website.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you there, and I've never quite understood them. However, young people these days, swear by them, and good luck to anybody who is seeking a partner in life. We talked about heroic women earlier on in this podcast, and not so heroic women, you know, like the author of The Talented Mr. Ripley. There's a woman here I want to talk to you about because it, excuse me, it's so fascinating. This lady's called Eleanor Wadsworth. She's aged 103. She just died, and she's Britain's last Spitfire pilot. And people listening to this might say, Spitfire pilot? We didn't have any female Spitfire pilots during the Second World War. We didn't, but we had a squadron of women who used to fly the Spitfires from the factories where they were made to the air bases where they were needed, including into France, and would, you know, fly in the fear of getting attacked by the Germans to land in French airfields and all this kind of stuff. Really, really heroic women. And Eleanor Wadsworth was one of them.
Yeah, I knew a bit about this because I had a friend called Giles Whittell who wrote a book called The Spitfire Women in World War II.
Oh, right,
quite
brilliant.
Successful. And they made it into a documentary. So I think this was the sort of genesis of the interest in all these people. And you're right, their job was transporting aircraft to the front lines.
Yes.
So they weren't involved in actual warfare, although some of them would have liked to be.
Yeah.
They were very brave. I loved what she said, Eleanor Wadsworth. She said that the thought of learning to fly for free, these ancient Spitfires, you know, she flew, that was her main incentive, by the way, for getting involved.
Yes.
But she flew Spitfires more than 130 times, imagine.
I know, isn't it utterly fantastic? When I was at school, in the junior school, you always used to ask the other kids what your dad did during the war. You know, people don't realise that I went to sort of junior school in the early 60s. That was less than 20 years after the end of the Second World War. So people, you know, you still said, oh, what did your dad do? And my dad was in the Navy for 6 years, you know. And they would say, oh, well, my dad was in the Army or whatever. And then one kid called Nicky Birchall said, oh, my dad was in the Army and my mum flew Spitfires. And I said, wow. What? He said, my mum used to fly Spitfire aeroplanes. I said, you're crazy. And then the story came out. His mother was one of these ladies who flew Spitfires from the factories to the front line, as you quite rightly say. Amazing. And she's probably only about 19 or 20 at the time.
Amazing story.
Yeah.
My father was only a little boy during the war. So it's
anybody
would ask me that question, I wouldn't know what to say. But my grandfather actually was around during the war, obviously. But he was playing football. He was playing for Everton at the time.
Lovely.
So, I think there were quite a lot of sort of exhibition matches.
Yes, there were.
There's a picture of him being presented to the king at Wembley during one of those exhibition matches, yeah.
Your grandfather?
Yeah. He was called Emlyn Jones, although he was known at Everton Football Club as Mickey Jones. You can look him up.
We had a T.E. Jones who played just in the 50s.
This is way earlier than
but
look him up, Mickey Jones.
He's
well known.
I will. Just one last thing on that one. It might have come out of your friend's book, but these ladies also flew even the very biggest aircraft like Lancaster bombers and Wellington bombers to get them to the front line. And when one of them landed at an airfield in Lincolnshire somewhere after flying it from the factory, which I think was over in Lancashire, she came down the ladder, you know, in the belly of the Lancaster bomber. And all the blokes on the ground said, where's the pilot? She said, I'm the pilot. And they said, no, don't be ridiculous. You're a young woman, you're a slip of a girl. You can't fly this. She said, I have. I've just brought this to you from the factory in Lancashire. They so didn't believe her, they all went into the plane and searched for the pilot. They thought the pilot must have fallen out of the plane when it landed on the ground.
That's because she had her high heels on.
Well, maybe, but there we are, you see, that's how it goes. Right, okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. I wish you, obviously, a very safe 2 or 3 days before we record again. Remember, it's getting serious out there, and not only to you, Miss Jones, but to all our millions of listeners, please look after yourselves and stay safe.
Indeed. See you soon.
Almost everybody I know, once they start drinking of a day, they don't just put it down and go away. They normally keep going. And I don't, certainly that's my case. If I go to the pub at lunchtime and have a few pints, I will easily be there till 4 o'clock. No problem at all. I won't be drunk, but I like a few pints and I like the atmosphere of the pub. No problem. So I can't see how Elaine Page can honestly take, you know, a couple of mouthfuls of champagne to start her day and then not continue doing it all day, because that's where most people fall foul of alcohol. They can't stop it once they start drinking it. Talking about flat sharing, by the way, did you ever go through a period of flat sharing during your young life?
No, never. I never wanted to.
No, well, you're very lucky because I never wanted to. But when I worked on the Chester Chronicle in Chester, still very young, I lived at home because it was just easy, you know what I mean? And so did all my mates. Oh, excuse me a sec, hang on.
Shall I get that? Oh, he's only taking the call. He's live on air on a podcast. He's taking a call. Let's just talk amongst myself, shall I? While we wait for Mr. Parry to return. Sorry, everyone.
I'm so sorry about that. Now, I'll tell you. Exactly
who was that? That it was more important than this podcast.
You won't believe it. It's the newspaper boy. Well, okay, we have to agree to disagree. I'm afraid a woman in high heels and long legs and finery and all that kind of stuff. But there we go. I'm a man. You're a woman.
Oh, you fetishist. Calm down, dear.
How dare you? How dare you?